Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is your Tech Guy podcast. The show originally aired on Sunday, June 12th, 2016. This is episode 1296. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by PillPack, a full-service online pharmacy that combines modern technology, convenient packaging, and personalized service to make your life easier. Visit PillPack.com/twit to save $20 on vitamins and over-the-counter drugs when you transfer your prescription. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your house. Go to Ring.com/tech guy and get $50 off the Ring of Security Kit with their limited-time offer. And by Ratio. Take control of your watering with the Ratio Smart Sprinkler Controller. It's Wi-Fi enabled to allow instant access with a mobile app and has automatic watering schedules based on the latest local forecasts to save you water and money. Go to Ratio.com/twit to learn more. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers and the internet and home theater and digital photography and smartphones and smart watches and virtual reality headgear and all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. I brought my virtual reality headgear, so I'm ready. If you have any questions, I will put on my visor. 888-827-5536. That's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, outside those areas. You can call collect. And we will talk high tech. 8888-ASK-LEO. I guess appropriate to send our condolences to the community in Orlando and the horrible shooting there, and just our prayers and our thoughts are with you. Terrible, terrible thing. But this show, we don't talk about news of the day, and you'll forgive me, but we just talk about technology. We talk about computers, and I think maybe sometimes it's just a respite sometimes from all the bad news and the politics and everything that's going on. Sometimes you just want to, let's talk about the toys, the toy store. And I'll stick with that today to cheer us up a little bit, huh? How about that? Except sometimes it's not very cheerful. Twitter, passwords leaked for millions of accounts. Oh, man. LinkedIn, password dump, millions of accounts revealed. One lesson from that, by the way. Twitter says we weren't hacked, but we think it came from the LinkedIn password leak, and that so many people use the same password on multiple sites, you know, LinkedIn and Twitter, that's what happened. MySpace. Remember, did you get an email from MySpace? For a lot of us, it was the reminder that, oh, I still have a MySpace. I do. I still have a MySpace account, so I changed the password there. I don't know why. Several Russian language sites. There's a site that published the Twitter's passwords. It says it has more. It's called Leaked Source. It says it has more than 1.8 billion passwords in its database in the clear. It sells access to that database for a fee. Nice people, huh? Nice. Nice people. That's good. Nice little business they got on the side there. Twitter's notifying you if they think your password's been compromised. They won't say how many, but they did say, yes, it's in the millions. Not a bad idea to change your password, but here's the most important thing, and I'll say it again. I've said it before. You got to have a password vault, a program that keeps track of all your passwords. Doesn't matter which one. There's lots. I use LastPass. I like that one, but a lot of people use 1Password, also very good. There's an open source solution called KeePass. The idea is, you know, truthfully, you could even do it in a notebook if you wanted to do that, and nobody had access. You're doing it at home. I wouldn't put it in your desk drawer at work. But if you're at home and nobody has access to it, put them in a notebook. That's what my mom used to do. That's fine. Do not put it in a file on your desktop called passwords.txt. My mom also used to do that. Don't do that. That's probably a bad idea because people can sometimes get into your computer. It's unlikely they're going to get into your home and. You know, don't say on the notebook, my passwords are in here. Just say my daily log or something. Put it somewhere not so obvious. That's okay. Better, though, to put it in an encrypted password vault, which is on your computer, but it's encrypted, so no one, even if they get it, can see into it. And then the most important discipline, and the reason you want to use a password vault, is to let the password vault generate strong, unique passwords every time you need one. That way, if somebody hacks LinkedIn, they don't have the password to everything else because you use the same password. I admit, when I first started out, back in the mid-90s when the internet, you know, kind of started taking off, I used the same password everywhere because we didn't know better. Little thought would tell you, yeah, that's kind of risky. If one of those password databases gets compromised, then all of them are. So different passwords. Somebody said you should change them regularly. I don't know if I agree with that. Now, sometimes at work they require you to change your passwords regularly. That may be their policy. Andrew, we use a sysadmin. Do you make your users change? Yeah, he said. How often? Every couple months? 90 days, 3 months, yeah. They do that at Premiere, too, the radio company that does this show. It drives me crazy because I don't log in more than once every 6 months. So inevitably, I have to call, if I want to get into my account, I have to call IT and say, what's my password? Which is kind of a pain in the butt. I'm not sure you need to change your passwords regularly. The theory, I guess, is that, well, if it does get compromised, you've changed it, and so you're limiting the damage. The problem I see is, well, you know your users. They change the password. They're going to not really change it. They're going to reuse them in cycle. They're not going to. Or worse, they say, oh, now it's a new password. I can't remember. Let me just write this down and put it on a post-it note on the monitor because they changed it, and I never can remember that. So sometimes changing it reduces security. So you have to really think about it. I wouldn't bother, you know, maybe once in a while change your Facebook password. The one you got to really pay attention to is your email. Because in some ways, that's the golden ticket. If somebody can get into your email, especially if it's like your primary email, and that's where you have, you know, password resets sent, then they have it all, right? Because they just go to your Twitter account and say, oh, I can't remember. Would you send me my password reset? And then they go to your email box and they thank you, and they reset your password to something they like. Twitter says, we're quite confident the records weren't stolen from our computers. I don't know how they could know that. I'm glad they're quite confident. There's no indication we've been compromised. Man, I don't know if I'd really trust that. For its part, leaked source, the source of all these passwords, says, we have very strong evidence. They probably say it like more like, we have very strong evidence. Twitter wasn't hacked. A consumer was hacked. I don't know why I'm making them Russian, but I think they... come on, let's... Consumer was hacked. Apparently, the way the database is created makes it look like it came from individuals' computers. Like, they got into people's computers and stole their passwords. Wow. Maybe it'd be better to have that notebook with the word password on the front. Just then they'd have to actually break into your house. That's too time consuming. Much easier just to hack a bunch of computers. Somebody says, my LinkedIn account was hacked. If you go to Have I Been Pwned, that's owned with a P. That's how the script kiddies spell it. Have I Been Pwned. PWNED.com. You can enter in your email address or your username and see if you're in one of those big databases. MySpace, get this, 359 million accounts were hacked. That's probably everybody. I'm thinking. That sounds like everybody. LinkedIn, 164 million. Adobe, 152 million. VK, a Russian site. Let me see. Leo, let me put in my password. Oh, no, Pwned. Pwned on 4 breach sites. Adobe? Well, I changed that password a while ago. LinkedIn, MySpace, and Tumblr. Compromised. My email address and my password and my username and all 4. Now, here's the good news. Contrary to my previous advice, I probably have changed all of those passwords recently. But anyway, you know, I don't really care. If you want to get into my Adobe or my MySpace account. You know, actually, if you're a hacker and you're in my MySpace account, could you tidy it up a little bit? It's probably got a lot of weeds and you know, it's kind of graffiti and stuff. Just tidy it up, would you, while you're in there? fix it up. The truth is, it's easy to get hacked. Everybody's going to get hacked at some point or other. The real question mark is, why would they hack you? And to kind of keep it away from it. I'm reading a wonderful book right now by a woman named Maria Konnikova. I interviewed her a few months ago. It's called The Confidence Game. And despite what you might think, the internet has proven a ripe field for cons. I guess you probably know that. If you listen to this show, people calling, pretending to be from Microsoft, saying, I think your computer is messed up. Let me get in, please. Or the Nigerian prince who wants to give you $43 million. And she says the problem is we all want to believe. That's why we're just gullible, because we're made to believe. Here's what I believe. Your calls are next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So all the people in the chat room now going to haveibeenpwned.com to check. And meanwhile, during the break, I was changing all my passwords. Well, better safe than sorry. I'll leave the MySpace. Be interesting to see if somebody hacked my MySpace. Like, why? What would they do with it? I'm glad to see I was really into the Bengals back then. Yeah. Big group. Loved that Susanna Hoffs. Yeah. And Tears for Fears. Loved them. Yeah. All the good. It's kind of not good to go to kind of visit an abandoned social network. You kind of see what you used to be like. It's kind of weird. Hello, Heather Hummon.
It's kind of Back to the Future.
Do you still have a MySpace account?
You know, I did have one at one time. I thought I never joined, but I did.
Of course you did. And I understand some people still use it. Doesn't Justin Timberlake own it now?
Is it kind of cool, like having
no,
AOL?
No, it's not
press,
cool.
Like,
it's never ironic. Been cool.
Well, it could be ironic, right?
Yeah. You know, wouldn't that be funny? Maybe I should just start sending out my MySpace handle.
Yeah. It's almost like steampunk. Like,
yeah. It's the new hipsters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a MySpace man. Oh, I don't use the Twitter or the Facebook. It's all about the MySpace. I guess bands still use it. It was really a music site, right? Mostly. And then along came Facebook and bye-bye MySpace. Anyway, might want to check to see if you're MySpace. That's the largest breach we've got right now. Over 350 million passwords. Wow. Anyway, we opened the lines, 888-827-5536. We've got the calls pouring in. And whose pour should I take?
Jonathan in Scottsdale.
Okay. Let's kick it off with Jonathan in Scottsdale. Hi, Jonathan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have a question. I have a Samsung Galaxy S6 through AT&T. And I've noticed this intermittent problem where it will lose location services.
Yeah.
And where I've noticed it primarily is on my Google Maps when I'm driving.
Yeah.
And also my my Nest thermostat will tend to send me messages saying that my phone is sending incorrect location information.
Isn't that interesting? So yeah. It's not that you're not getting location information. It says you're in Tallahassee or something.
Incorrect. Not sure if it knows where.
Well, a Nest thermostat would have a pretty good idea. It says suddenly if you were in Scottsdale one day and you're in Florida another, that wouldn't probably make sense. So that probably is why it's saying that. So here's the deal. Sometimes this happens because your phone is not getting its location from GPS, but from Wi-Fi. Now, I'm sure that you've looked at your location settings and you have a fine location accuracy turned on, the highest accuracy. Do you? Your GPS?
Yes, I do. And actually, this is always when I'm on the data network, not on the Wi-Fi.
Aha, interesting. The data network sometimes identifies itself, depends on who your company is, as the home office. So Sprint users often seem to be coming from Kansas City. And who's your company?
I have AT&T. And I will say this is a...
And where do you be? Do you know where you appear to be coming from?
You know, it doesn't really tell me. What I've really noticed is I'll be driving along and an area that I'm in all the time, and Google Maps will just say, cannot find signal or cannot find location. And then, I will add, this is actually a replacement device because my first Galaxy S6 got super duper hot.
Yeah.
So that they had to do a warranty replacement.
This was a lost generation for most smartphones. They were using a Qualcomm chip, the 810, that was notoriously hot and unreliable. And it wasn't just Samsung, but everybody except Apple got bit by this because they used the Snapdragon 810. And all of those phones had either overheating problems or they had to be underclocked. HTC, for instance, made an 810 phone, but they decided not to run it at full speed because of these overheating problems. Samsung and the rest of the world, they only use this chip in the U.S. The rest of the world, they use their own Exynos chips, and I think for this reason. So, this is kind of a known problem, frankly, with the S6 and every phone of that generation, last year's high-end smartphones.
Gotcha. I called AT&T, and the first thing they had me do is reset my Google Maps, which pretty much didn't do anything.
No.
And the next step, they wanted me to just completely factory reset my device.
Yeah, of course. That's you're going to get that if you call Dell about your Windows machine, if you call Apple about your Apple Mac. The first thing they're going to do is say, well, it could be some software you installed, so what we're going to have you do is wipe it and restore it. That way we'll at least know what it looks like. We'll know what software you're running. But, of course, to the end user, that's like a nightmare. That's like, I'm not going to start over. That's terrible. So the good news is on a smartphone, most Android phones, you've got it all backed up. So if you haven't, go to the Samsung account, log in, turn on backup. This is in your settings, backup and reset settings. Go and also do the same with Google. And that will back up most of your settings. You won't have too hard a problem getting it back to where it was. It may not fix it. It may not even be related. You understand, they do it not because they think that's going to fix it, but just because they want to get to a known state.
Yeah.
It may be you have a bad GPS. But even if they think, oh, there's physical hardware problem with that phone, they're going to make you do that first. As annoying as this is, but that's what everybody does because they don't know it's not some app you put on there.
Yeah.
Right?
I just was reluctant to do a full device wipe.
Have you tried other map apps, put Waze on there or anything else and see if they work?
I have not, actually. That's a good idea.
I try there's the Open Maps project. There are a number of Open Maps apps like MapMyRide.com. I would try Waze. Try some other maps just to see if it's the phone giving the map app the wrong information. I'm sure it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the Nest complaint, you know, the thermostat complaint, that means the Nest app is also getting unaccountable, bizarre location information.
Exactly. I'm just wondering if maybe there's some utilities out there or something that might be able to do some analysis. But the problem is it is kind of an intermittent problem. It's not happening all the time. So I don't know if it's, you know, the phone gets hot and maybe there's some kind of that just...
Could
you know,
be
or something.
Or yeah, just a bad GPS chip or an intermittently bad GPS radio. It could also be that, as I said, sometimes, you know, the location information. If you know, look at your Google Maps. This is one way to tell that. Google keeps track of your location unless you've disabled that. So if you go to google.com/dashboard and look at location history, if it'll show your what your phone's reporting is your location history. If you suddenly go to Dallas and then come back. That means your AT&T network is identifying itself as coming out of Dallas, and the phone is using that because for some reason it can't get GPS. Boom, you're in Dallas, and boom, you're back. When I travel, I get that a lot. The airplane's Wi-Fi comes from Florida. The cruise ship's Wi-Fi comes from Florida. Things like that, and you'll see it on your map as sudden, like in 15 minutes you've traveled halfway around the world. So check that. It's google.com/dashboard. Look at location history. If you have that turned on, that'll give you some idea of what's happening and how it's happening. But it does sound like it could just be an overheating problem or a GPS radio problem. And again, this generation, sad to say, the 2015 crop of smartphones, all the ones with the Snapdragon 810, all had problems of one kind or another. We're so glad. We now have the 820. We're past those days. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Nathan, if you feel like taking a request, I heard Chuck Prophet do his great song Summertime yesterday live, and it's so pretty.
You are a music maven.
Would you say Chuck Prophet?
Yeah, he's kind of a local guy, but that was his one semi-hit from Summer of Whatever.
Summertime, summertime, summertime. This is the worst music. Da-da-da-da. Da 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 da.
Plus, they've literally been playing this for over a decade, I think, as the film.
Yeah. Since 2000. Well, since 2007. 9 years.
But I think they used it on Adele even earlier.
Oh, you know this, like, music
I've
from
been
Adele?
I've by it forever. I'm having nightmares.
I have. I was going because we're cleaning out the basement. Man, that's that kind of a sad thing. I played some sad music as I wandered through there. It's like pieces of my life strewn on the floor.
And it's like your MySpace account.
I should show you. There's a box of carts down there. It is. It's like my MySpace.
Whoa.
It's a box of carts. There are places I remember.
Oh, so, don't you? I'll cry.
So here's my MySpace account. It actually looks pretty nice. Mostly because this isn't really anything. Here's me. I guess they're still feeding stuff in here. What's the latest? MySpace. It's back, man. All the cool kids are doing it. And wait a minute, I should add summertime. What's the name of it? Chuck Prophet? Chuck, let's see if Chuck's on MySpace.
Yeah, I just looked it up. It's summertime.
P-R-O-F-I-T or two Fs?
P-R-O-P-H-E-T, like prophet, yeah.
Oh, he's a prophet. He's a prophet without a country.
Kim was there with me. We were singing
summertime.
In the sunshine.
Yeah, summertime thing?
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm adding that to my MySpace post.
Woo-woo.
Woo. And there you go. It's a summertime thing. Part of the No Other Love album. See, the kids today, they're missing out. This could be great.
Do you know about him? He's the Chuck from Chucky's in Love by Ricky Lee.
You're
Jones.
Kidding.
That is what I've always been told.
Wow. Wow. I'm playing this from my MySpace account, a little Chuck Prophet music. It's a great place to discover music. You know, I have to say, I feel bad. Because MySpace is actually looking pretty good. No more of those weird wallpaper backgrounds and, you know, the dancing unicorns. Remember, all that stuff? It's actually pretty good. And a lot of musicians there. It'd be a good place to listen to music. You can share music. I wonder, maybe it's time for MySpace. Doesn't Justin Timberlake own a stake in that? Let's bring MySpace back. Let's do it. Let's bring it back. I'm sure my kids still have their MySpace accounts. Actually, it's interesting. My daughter's 24. My son's 21. Abby used MySpace. And then Henry, who was just a couple of years younger, was a Facebook kid. That was the transition right there when they were about 13, 14, 15, something like that. That was the transition 10 years ago. And she tried to get him on MySpace. He said, no, nobody uses MySpace anymore. It's all Facebook. And she went to Facebook eventually. She went to it too. What is sad? I met MySpace Tom. You know, when you joined MySpace, you'd all have one friend. Remember that? Some guy was wearing a T-shirt. He was looking over his shoulder. That was MySpace Tom. He was everybody's friend. He was one of the founders of MySpace, and he's a cool guy. I met him the other. We actually came here. We took him to lunch. Next door had Korean barbecue. He has a little money. I think he has several homes in L.A. and mostly does travel and take pictures. He's a quite a good photographer. So actually, MySpace Tom is actually my friend now. I should friend him on MySpace. Come to think of it, 8888 Ask Leo. That's my proudest moment. I am actual friends with MySpace Tom. Moving on. Sorry. Fanboy thing going here. Ron in Baltimore, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I got a question for you. I have a tiny hardware firewall, which you recommended,
love
and
it.
I like it.
Yeah.
But I've been thinking, what is, once you're connected with the VPN, which is built into that, what does the firewall add to just the VPN? In other words, if I walked into whatever, so the Starbucks, and connected to a VPN, wouldn't I have the same kind of protection, or is there something added with the firewall?
You would kind of. Having a basically, the tiny hardware firewall acts as a router, right? And one of the reasons we like routers is because they're the attack surface, not your smarter computer. So the hardware, tiny hardware firewall, anybody tries to use a hacking program in there, more than just capturing your data, but to kind of penetrate it, is going to get this dumb device that doesn't know anything and just says, I don't know, and goodbye. Now, there's always the risk. Of course, it would require a security flaw in all likelihood in your system. But there's always the risk if the attack surface is your system, even if you're running a VPN, that they may glean some information there. For instance, I've seen hackers be able to see what other Wi-Fi access points you had joined in the past and then put up a dummy Wi-Fi access point with the same name. And you know how computers can be a little promiscuous. They see a familiar – this is, I think, a security issue. They see a Wi-Fi access point they've joined before, and they go, oh, yeah, I've been here before, and join it. And if that's the bad guy's Wi-Fi access point, he now has a man-in-the-middle attack on you. He's actually between you and the outside world. Now, in theory, a VPN is going to protect you against that. So you do have much of the protection of a VPN, but you're just trusting that there's no flaw – on that much bigger attack. You understand the computer is a bigger attack surface. There are many more places you could take advantage of it. The tiny hardware firewall is a very small attack surface. Not much you can do with it. So it's like using a router at home. It gives you a little extra protection. You know, that's an interesting question. I'll have to talk to some of my white hat hacker friends. People like Darren Kitchen, who makes or sells the Wi-Fi Pineapple. This is a device that he bills as a pen testing or security testing device that actually could be used by a bad guy in a cafe to try to attack systems. I'll have to ask him, is it enough just to be running a VPN on your computer, or would you be a little safe? My gut is you'd be a little safer, but I'm not sure exactly what the attack vector would be if you were using a tiny hardware firewall. I think, you know, you're just limiting the problems that could be caused. Remember, there's always exploits in these operating systems, these complicated operating systems like Windows and Macintosh. And so you got to make sure you're really bolted down. That's why. And yeah. I like the other advantage of the tiny hardware firewall is it can be a router for up to 5 other devices. So I always have my phone join it and my laptop. That way, you know, if you've even – so this is a genuine risk. If you're sitting in a cafe, even if you're not surfing, but you have a device that has Wi-Fi enabled on it, like your smartphone, it is a risk if somebody is a sophisticated hacker because, as I said, they can probe it. So having everything beyond the tiny hardware firewall, even if you're not surfing the net with it, is probably a good idea.
That's another point, I suppose. I could have the smartphone in my pocket, and exactly. If it finds, like, around here, Xfinity or something, it could connect.
Doesn't that drive you crazy?
I don't want to be on it.
Yeah.
Crazy, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a real security flaw because, you know, this is Xfinity's idea to kind of put internet everywhere. If you're an Xfinity customer, as I am, and apparently you are, you can say, okay, and anytime there's an Xfinity open access point, which is everybody who has an Xfinity router, by the way, unless they explicitly turn it off, I should join it.
Unless they didn't get the new router.
Right. Or
like I did.
Or it could be a bad guy sitting at his you know, Kali-based Linux machine who is spoofing an Xfinity Wi-Fi adapter. And it looks for all intents and purposes to be exactly like a legitimate Xfinity router. Now you've joined that. And I wonder how often that happens. How many times do does your phone kind of spontaneously join this Xfinity router and have no internet access? Sometimes, right?
It certainly happens, and I've actually thought of telling my iPhone to not connect to Xfinity.
I've turned that off. It's a great convenience, right. But I've turned that off because I don't know who that is. There's no verification of who that is. You're just joining some person's Wi-Fi access point. And I don't trust Comcast to get it right. So,
no.
Right?
No,
you can trust your security to Comcast? Good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the point. And, you know, I don't want people to be paranoid. Most of the time you're safe. The sad state of affairs is if somebody is really determined to get you, it's hard to prevent it. And so if you're a public figure, if you're somebody, you know, that is a ripe target, you know, you're going to be attacked. Most of us just wander around in obscurity and, you know, there's not a lot of payoff to attacking us, so people just leave us alone. So, I mean, that's not a good way to have security, and it's certainly a good idea to do everything you can. But let's not be paranoid, because you can't completely thwart all attacks, I don't think. There's your question. Yeah. There's your answer. It's at tinyhardwarefirewall.com. I use it, and I really like it. I don't like to use open Wi-Fi access points.
No, I've been very happy with it. Yeah. As I think you said on your little video on it, the one problem is they only have places in the U.S., but most of the time, that's fine for me.
Right. So. It's owned or somehow related to Hotspot VPN, and I wish it would work with other VPNs. It probably does. Those are just boxes that they buy from some Chinese manufacturer, I'm sure.
I saw that. You could actually kind of reboot it and just have a device.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably a good idea. It would be worth doing. Then you could join any VPN with it. Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. VPN stands for Virtual Private Network. The idea is if you're in public and you're on the internet, you shouldn't just be doing it naked to the world. You should have some protection, so to speak. We call it safe computing. And in this case, a VPN is an encrypted tunnel that you're going through that nobody can penetrate. That's a good thing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You know, I'm liking this MySpace. I really think of this as the future of social networking. Let's find and invite some friends, though, because nobody's here. Your browser blocked the authorization pop-up. Oh, welcome back, MySpace. I missed you. Authorization pop-ups. Why? Intermittent.
I just picked that one up.
I'm going to allow pop-ups from MySpace. Log into Facebook with your MySpace account. What could possibly go wrong? MySpace would like to post publicly to Facebook for you. Sure, that sounds like a good idea. Oh, well, none of my Facebook friends are on MySpace anymore. Man, let's try the Twitter. Authorize MySpace. This is really sad. I don't have any Facebook friends on MySpace or Twitter.
Lunch.
No, I have lunch. Thank you very much.
That was her question.
That was her question, and that was my answer. I have no friends.
You're waving a piece of paper at
her. That doesn't bug me. Cat couldn't possibly bug me. Let's see. Insights. Insights. It'll probably tell me you don't have any friends. You don't know insights at all. Connections. Katy Perry and I were connected. Yeah.
Really?
Well, that's just because I added her.
I think I'm just going to start a whole new account because now that I look back, I think I used a pseudonym.
See, there's MySpace Tom. That's MySpace Tom. I'm hanging out with MySpace Tom.
Dude,
see?
He's hot.
See? I should have said, put on a T-shirt and look over your shoulder. That's MySpace Tom, my buddy, my close personal friend. And ironically, my only friend on MySpace. That's pretty funny. I doubt he's on MySpace anymore. And then there's a picture of me bald.
Oh, remember the days?
Ah, those were the days, my friend. And then there's Chuck Prophet, summertime thing.
So I'm going to start a new account, and it says you can just use Facebook or Twitter.
Yeah.
This is going to really take off because it's going to tell all
it's
my
huge.
Facebook and Twitter friends that I have a MySpace account.
I have 2 gigabytes of storage. I can upload all my songs. I can create a new album. I love it. It's a part of the People Entertainment Weekly Network. What? Is that who owns them? Come on. Press room. Our backstory. 2003. MySpace was founded by everyone's first friend, Tom Anderson and Krista Wolf. 2011. Justin Timberlake bought the site with Tim Vanderhook and Chris Vanderhook. 2012. At 12:00 hours, Justin Timberlake tweeted a video debuting the newly redesigned MySpace to the world. June 2013. New platform. It actually is a nice new platform. Today we have an eclectic team of 150 engineers, designers, writers, and strategists who live and breathe MySpace. Wow. Huh. That's it. The last press release in 2013. They haven't been really that busy in the last few years. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. The website is techguylabs.com. I'm addicted to the shindig. Yes, sir. Back to the phones we go. Tony in Corning, California. Hey, Tony.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Leo. I had a quick question. I know a couple months ago Linux Mint was hacked, and I know every time you download an ISO from anybody, they tell you to double-check that it's actually a legitimate ISO.
Oh, great, great question. Yes.
Yes, and most of the instructions that I'm finding, like when you download an ISO from Linux Mint or Ubuntu, it says to how to check the ISO in like Ubuntu.
In Linux.
Yes, and I'm trying to find some way, and like I downloaded the beta of Linux Mint 18.
Yeah.
And I don't even think they're using, I think it's called, is it MD5?
MD5, yeah.
And is it something else called like AES256?
AES256 is usually associated with PGP or GPG, another way to sign. So here's the deal. Signing is a good way to assure that you're getting what you thought you were getting. And they go hand in hand. So first they do what's called a hash, which is they go through the whole file and they create an MD5 hash, a number, a unique long number, that represents the contents of the file. If the file were to be changed, even in one bit, a different hash would be generated. So if a bad guy, and this is what happened with Linux Mint, a bad guy got to the Linux Mint website, hacked it, and pointed the download links to his own server in Turkey. And if you downloaded Linux Mint, because it's open source, it was easy for a bad guy to take the full source of it and just add a little code that's his own. I can't remember what it was, a keystroke logger or something. But he had a little something, something, something. And you would download it, and it would look like Linux Mint. Now, the hash would not match because it's been modified. So that's the idea of the hash. The second part of the verification is with a signing key, and that's the AES-256. That's the PGP, or usually they use an open source program called GPG, which is the same technology, but it's open source. And what it does is it says this authenticated hash is signed by an authenticated PGP key from the developers of the software. And by the way, it's not just Linux, it's all software, all open source software certainly uses this. A lot of software uses. Even Microsoft uses this. If you download a Windows ISO from Microsoft for purposes of installing Windows 10, ISO, by the way, is a file that represents a bootable image that you could put on a CD, DVD, or USB key. That's what an ISO is. And before you do that and boot from it and install it, you want to verify that it is intact, A, that it's intact, and B, that it came from the actual place you think it came from. So the hash verifies its intactness, and the key, the signing key, verifies that it came from who you think it did. So the fact that you can do this on Microsoft's Windows site tells you you can do this on any operating system. Of course, if you're downloading a copy of Linux, they're going to give you instructions for doing it on Linux. But if you download it from Microsoft's site, you can see the programs they recommend and so forth. Let me just quickly check. They'll give you a long hash, which is the key.
Because what I did is I did a search for like an MD5 utility for Windows.
Yeah.
And then I went to...
that's exactly what you should do.
And there were so many of them. And then when I did a search for different programs, it said don't download because it might be a virus.
Well, here's the problem.
So it's been
you could get a modified MD5 program that didn't give you the right results. So you want to get – so first of all, bottom line is computing is a matter of trust, especially when you're using closed source programs because you can't look at the source code. You just have to trust that Microsoft or whoever wrote it didn't do anything nefarious. Lots of people kind of presume that big companies like Microsoft, Google, and Apple – insert code from the federal government that spies on you. I don't think that's true, but you can't prove otherwise because you don't get to look at it. So open source, you or somebody who has some expertise can look at it and at least kind of verify it does what it seems to say it's doing and doesn't seem to have anything sneaky in there. And so you generally, I do recommend using open source tools for MD5 verification and get it from a trusted source. Don't get it from, you know, hacker.com and for PGP verification. Having said that, you also can trust that if you're downloading a Linux distro, you're downloading the same thing that a lot of other sophisticated users have checked. So the Linux Mint issue, for instance, was only an issue for 24 hours because people checked it and said, whoa, hold on here. This isn't it. And so it was very quickly came to people's attention. So it would
exactly.
You can kind of, in open source anyway, you're resting, there's still trust, but you're trusting that the open source community has verified this. And so I wouldn't, it is kind of a pain. Once you get Linux installed, it's a very simple two-step process. You download the key, you download the MD5, you run it, and it says, yes, this is verified. And that's a nice thing. It makes you feel better about what you're installing. But it doesn't protect you 100% because, as you point out, the tool could be modified and so forth and so on. That would take a big conspiracy, though, right? Because then somebody would have to modify Linux Mint and then modify the thing that you were using to verify it. It would be a big deal, and it probably wouldn't last very long. So in my experience, I sometimes will run the verification. I kind of use my judgment. If I'm downloading software from a place I'd never downloaded before, I will do that. But if you're downloading a Linux ISO from a big developer, you know, wait a couple of days and see if alarm bells go off.
Exactly.
Right? Wait a couple of days. But yeah, but people who downloaded that bad Linux Mint did get bit. And it really kind of raised the issue in my mind of how well the Linux Mint community is protecting its users. And it actually is one of the reasons I stopped using that particular version of Linux and went back a couple of generations to the version it's based on, which is called Debian. That has a very large, active, and very smart community. It's one of the oldest versions of Linux. And they are very careful about how they run their servers and how they do it. And, you know, I think much more so than the Linux Mint community. So I trust Debian a little bit better. And, you know, nowadays, Debian is as easy to install as anything else. I think it's my distribution of choice for people who want to try Linux on the desktop. But remember, computing in general is a game of trust. But life is. I often use this analogy. When you're driving down the road, you're trusting that the guy coming in the other direction at 60 miles an hour is not going to, at the last minute, turn his wheel into you. You have to trust that, or you wouldn't drive. We live in a society where we're dependent on other people. We trust people all the time. We trust that microwave oven was properly constructed so it's not beaming microwaves into my brain. We just trust. We have to, because we're all dependent. We're all interdependent upon one another. And it's somewhat true in software. Almost all software, certainly anything that's not open source, is a blob that you don't know what it does. You just have to trust that the person who wrote it had some integrity. And sometimes I wonder, maybe that's the thing we shouldn't trust. It's one of the reasons for encryption, if you're going to use encrypting software to scramble your messages, I always say use an open source program. Maybe you and I don't have the skills to look at the programming code and verify that nothing bad's happening, but people do, many people do, and many eyes are looking at it, and it's just much more likely that it can be trusted. And it also has an advantage because bugs will happen, bugs always happen in software, but will often be fixed faster, and it's a more transparent process. I kind of prefer that. But there's a lot of trust in everything we do in life, and technology in particular. We put a lot of trust in that. Because you know what? You and I, most people don't. If we were to lose the engineers, the geniuses that built these things, would we be able to create microchips, microprocessors, RAM memory? Would we be able to create solid-state drives that hold terabytes of data? Would we be able to do that? No. We just trust the men and women who are doing that know what they're doing. Crossing my fingers. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. It's an interesting philosophical question, and probably one we don't like to bring up a lot because it undermines our faith. We wander through life without thinking a lot about that, as we should, because otherwise you'd be living inside terrified. And some people actually do, and that's sad. You got to trust. It's okay. We'll make it. We're all pretty good people. There's a few bad people, a few bad apples. Spoil it for the rest of us. Most of us are, I think, pretty good. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. Website, again, techguylabs.com. You know what we'll do? We'll put some information on how to verify your download in Windows and other operating systems up there. Techguylabs.com. You know, the larger problem I have with Mint is it really is just a distribution about a desktop. They, you know, the Cinnamon desktop. And you can put the Cinnamon desktop on Debian. And I think you'll have a more secure version of Linux by doing so, and more stable version of Linux. We're going to take a break. Top of the hour. Time to mention our sponsor today, PillPack.com. Where's my... I got a pill pack right here. This is kind of a cool idea. You have elders in the family. You know, that's one of the questions. Did you take your pills today, Mom? With PillPack, there's no guessing. This is a full-service pharmacy that happens to be online, but one of the great advantages of PillPack, besides the fact that you can talk to a pharmacist 24/7 in the privacy and convenience of your own home, is that when they deliver your medications, they deliver them by mail, they pay the shipping, you don't have to pay for it. They deliver the pills in this great PillPack, hence the name. With PillPack, you don't have to sort your pills out into, you know, your pill minders. You don't have to wonder, did I get the right prescriptions? It's all done this way with the image recognition. Look, here's how the box comes. It has your name, your date, so you know it's yours. It has an image of each medication. It could be vitamins, by the way, or over-the-counter medications, as well as prescription. The name, the dosing information, the prescription information, and over here, the dosing directions. And it's all there, very easy to see. And then your pills are divided into these easy-to-open plastic pouches, and they say the date, the time, the day, what's in them. You can even look on the back. These are clear plastic. That's how the imaging system works. And by the way, after the imaging system verifies the pills, a pharmacist looks at it and verifies as well. So you know you're always getting exactly the medications. And there's never a question, did I take my pills this morning? You know. This is real. Or, you know, you wouldn't do it. You overdo it either. You don't take them, double them up, because you know. It says, oh, it's not 12 p.m. yet. I can't take these. I can wait, save them. It's also great for travel, by the way. You just tear off the pill packs you need, throw them into your carry-on. You've got everything you need. 24/7, you can speak to the pharmacists at PillPack. They are a better kind of pharmacy, an online pharmacy. And by the way, most insurance programs work great with PillPack. That means you, including most forms of Medicare Part D, that means it costs you no more than it would for anything else. It's just you pay your usual copay. The service is free. The pack's free. The shipping is free. PillPack. It's brilliant. And maybe for your the elders in your family, your parents, your grandparents, this would be a real boon. Easy to open, too. None of those silly childproof. I mean, if you got kids, you probably should get chopped. But this is, but it's, isn't it sad that older people have to try to open childproof? I can't open them. It's human proof. PillPack.com. These are easy. PillPack.com/twit if you want to sign up. It'll take you just a couple of minutes. They can verify your insurance right there. And when, by the way, they'll transfer your prescriptions over, and they even handle refills automatically. They when it's time for a refill, they contact your physician, and they get the authorization, and they do it automatically. So you don't have to think about it. It just comes in the mail. So you're always ready. You don't have to, oh, I got to get my refills. No, it happens. PillPack.com/twit, and you'll get a credit when you transfer your prescriptions over for $20 worth of vitamins and over-the-counter meds. Nice. PillPack.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers and the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, virtual reality headgear, the toy store. The toy store. We need a little light relaxation today. It's been a tough day. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada outside that area. You call collect. No, don't call collect. Heather is not authorized to accept collect calls, but you can call via Skype. And that won't cost you anything, won't cost us anything, and everybody will be happy. Brett is in Woodbridge, New Jersey, our next caller. Hey, Brett.
Hey, Leo. I have a question because the other day I called Daryl about my basic warranty support because my desktop, Windows 10, that had performance issues, and they installed a program called Dell Quick to Fix.
Yes.
And now my computer is way faster now. Everything's responding super fast. So I'm happy, but I found out that that's only for the Dell technicians, and the guy even saved it on my computer so I can burn it to a DVD for after the warranty if I need it again. But now I heard that it's only on there until 7 days, and then it goes away. So my question is there any open source programs that you know about that would do the same thing as Dell CryptoFix? Because that program is really good, the Dell CryptoFix.
Yeah, Dell doesn't share the secret sauce in Click2Fix, and I'd be very careful about buying a program that offers to do similar things that you see as advertised on TV. You know what I'm talking about. Those programs are, generally speaking, not very good. Dell's Click2Fix. Well, and I don't, you know, again, I don't know if there's anything I would recommend. One of the advantages Dell has with Click2Fix is they know what hardware you're using. So it's a Dell product for Dell products. And one of the things we do know it does, Dell's very closed-mouthed about what it does, but one of the things we do know it does is it will check and make sure you have all the right drivers. And that's something that makes a lot of sense. Dell can do it easily. A third-party program isn't necessarily going to do that as well. I would guess that anything Click2Fix does, you can do yourself if you know what you're doing. So the first thing you would do is you would make sure you have the latest drivers from Dell. Dell has driver downloads, and you want to make sure you're using the right drivers for the right operating system. I don't know what else Click2Fix does because Dell won't tell anybody. My guess is probably nothing too aggressive. You know, you'll see programs that do things like clean up the registry. CCleaner is one of those that a lot of people swear by and recommend. The problem I see with CCleaner and others is to be really effective, they have to be aggressive. But if it's really aggressive, then it can cause problems. It can delete registry keys that are still in use, even though the program couldn't tell. So CCleaner and many of these other programs have a choice. They either can be very effective and risky, or they can be very conservative and useless. And there really isn't much of a middle ground. Dell, again, has an advantage because they're working on Dell hardware. And so they can do stuff. If this is probably the most respectable of the third-party programs that do something similar. It's from a company called Piriform, P-I-R-I-F-O-R-M. There's a free version and a pro version. Most of them do basically the same things. They'll delete cache and temp files, which might save some disk space. They'll go through your registry and delete unused keys. You know, sometimes, frequently, in fact, you'll uninstall software on Windows, but the registry doesn't get cleaned up afterwards. And that's for good reason. You don't want to mess with the registry. It's so vital to the operation of Windows that if you messed it up, you would mess up your installation. And that's a risk that a lot of these, if I were Piriform, I wouldn't want to take. Let me ask Andrew, as a professional sysadmin, is there anything that you use with your clients at the company you work for that you go in and you clean the machines up? I bet you what you do is you go in and you wipe the machines and reinstall because you have an image. It's the best way to do it. You already have an image that you built the machine with in the first place, just as Dell does. I think for most people, even at home, that's not a bad idea. Reinstall Windows. Back up your data. Reinstall Windows. That's going to do a better job than CCleaner or anything else can do. Any patch, any Band-Aid you put on a problem is not going to be as good as just getting rid of the problem. So you can try CCleaner. There's another program. You want to make sure you get it from Piriform.com and not some. This is the other problem. We were talking about this earlier. A lot of times programs are posing as legitimate, well-known programs in order to get you to put malware on your system. So do not download programs from third-party download sites. Do not download it. You know, if you Google CCleaner, you will find, besides the actual program, many imposters that could be dangerous. So go to Piriform, and we'll put a link in the show notes for CCleaner. Another one that is often spoofed is Malwarebytes. This is a good program from a good company, malwarebytes.org. And this is a malware cleaner. systems that get slowed down are often slowed down because you are running other processes for other people that you didn't even know about. So not a bad idea to check for malware. Again, the best way to do this, and this is how they'll do it in your business, is erase everything on the drive, back up your data, erase the hard drive, and install a known good copy of Windows. It's easily the best way to fix this. And by the way, it'll run really fast once again. I do this pretty regularly. Windows, ever since Windows 8, installs pretty fast now. Microsoft has changed the way Windows install happens. It used to be it kind of copy a lot of files and run a lot of stuff. Now they blast an image on the disk, and it's much faster than it used to be. David in Whitehall, Wisconsin. Hi, David. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi.
Hey.
My question was for you. I stopped using Windows a while back, and I found that Fedora Linux was easy to install. And people on the internet were telling me to try to use a different version of Linux, but Fedora is the only one that comes with a firewall installed.
Fedora is fantastic. I don't know who would tell you not to use Fedora.
People were trying to tell me to use Debian.
I like Debian. Fedora's been around for a very long time. I've used Fedora for years. It is completely legitimate version of Linux. So all Linuxes are basically similar. They're based on the operating system kernel, the lowest level thing designed by Linus Torvalds. And then the people who make these distributions, whether it's Debian or Mint or Fedora or Red Hat, they add additional stuff. Most notably, package managers, which allow you to install different software. And Fedora uses an RPM system that's a little different than Debian's APT or Deb system. And that's just like chocolate versus vanilla. It's not a significant difference, but it does make these unique. And then they sometimes distribute different kinds of programs with it. As you point out, Fedora might come with a firewall, but so does Debian. If it didn't, you could easily install it. So it's one of those things where there's not that much difference between different Linuxes. Sometimes there's differences in how they approach it. For instance, Debian stable, and somewhat to the case also with Ubuntu stable, they try to make sure that they don't break it. So you may not get the latest versions of different programs, but you've got well-known, stable, secure versions. And for a lot of people, that's what they want. Same thing with Fedora. Fedora has a rolling distribution, but you'd probably want the stable distribution. I love Fedora. Fedora is based on Red Hat. It's very good. Red Hat's a commercial Linux used by a lot of businesses and servers. Absolutely no qualms about saying go ahead and use Fedora. Anybody who tells you otherwise is being a religious zealot. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. They're all the same. In other words, there's slight differences. Chocolate versus vanilla.
If you use a free credit monitoring service, you may think it's your identity, but
I am going to take a while. I like Debian. Debian's been around almost as long as Slackware, as Linux itself. I feel like, you know, to some degree when you choose a Linux, you're trusting the team behind it. And what I like about Debian, it's all volunteers. There's no corporate involvement, which there is, for instance, with Ubuntu and Red Hat as well. You know, Fedora is kind of the open version of Red Hat. I like the idea that Debian is just, it's created by Linux geeks and gurus for Linux geeks and gurus. And I think they do a very good job. They have very high standards. I like them, but I don't think it matters all that much. I'm using Ubuntu on my newest Linux box just because that's what the company supports, System 76 supports. It's doing very well. The only issue with the System 76 is that incompatibility with the HDMI to SDI converters we use from Blackmagic. The converter, so with the System 76, you can probably see me banging my head against this HDMI issue. What I didn't realize, I plug it into a TV, it works fine. Audio and video, everything's fine. It's these converters. And what I'm thinking, and I actually have to kind of continue to search around, maybe you know, the converters only support two different sample rates, 48K, and I can't remember what the other one was, like kind of an unusual, like 32K. And they don't support 44.1 and other common formats. And I think what's happening is that the audio is coming out at a sample rate that the HDMI converter doesn't understand. When I give it 48K audio, pink noise audio, works fine. And when I plug the System 76 into a TV set, works fine. So somehow I have to convince the... It's an NVIDIA driver, and I think that's probably it. I have to somehow convince the NVIDIA driver to output the audio at 48K. I think that's the only issue. Yeah, boring is good in like CentOS. Boring is good because you know, if you're running it as an operating system for your server, you don't want exciting. You don't want exciting. I would look at, if instead of Mint, I would look at Debian with the Cinnamon. You can put the Cinnamon desktop on it. It looks just like Mint, and I think it's a little more reliable. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo. The website is techguylabs.com. It's interesting, isn't it? We have, now maybe it's my fault, because I've been talking about Linux a bit, but we're getting a lot of calls about Linux, and I really think that there is a trend that we can start to monitor, and I think it comes from the fact that Microsoft has really blown it with Windows 10. People are upset that Microsoft is pushing Windows 10 so hard, upgrading people without their permission automatically, trying to trick people into upgrading. And then there's also the privacy concerns people have about Windows 10. I think those are probably overblown, but nevertheless, I think all of this combines to push people in a different direction. And while some people might look at Apple as an alternative, Apple computers are very expensive. And I don't know that Apple is any better in some of this. I feel like they've kind of, their attention has wandered in some respects from their desktop operating systems. They're doing so well in phones that, well, they're just focusing on phones. And so I think a lot of people are looking at the very active, vibrant, exciting community, provides a lot of choice that Linux represents. And Linux has come a long, long way. I mean, it is really not so hard to install. I know a lot of geeks, the kind of people who listen to and participate to this show, who install it for family and friends, saying you'll be safer. You're going to be able to do everything you want to do in Windows. It's not going to look so weird or different to you. And I think if done right, if chosen carefully, that is actually the case. You can be very safe and solid and easy to use and not have to worry about suddenly waking up one morning and you're running Windows 10. Older hardware works very well on Linux, so a lot of people are taking older PCs with, you know, older versions of Windows, like Windows XP, and putting Linux on it. And I think it's good. I think it's a good trend. I like to see that. So certainly we'll answer questions about Linux and Windows and OS X. Because the truth at the bottom, the truth is it's all pretty much the same. It's just technology. It's just a computer. Whether it's in your pocket, it's on your lap, or it's on your desk, it's just a computer. 8888, ask Leo. Chad in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hello, Chad.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Very good. Actually, this may be related to what you were just talking about. I have a laptop that's probably about 8 years old or so. It's a beast of a thing. It hardly fits on my lap. And so I heard about this cloud-ready software.
Yeah.
That's supposed to install the Chromium operating system on there. And so I installed that. It seems to be working okay. I didn't know if there's a way to reduce some of the weight of this gigantic laptop I have. Instead of, I may bite the bullet and buy a Chromebook. I thought, if I can use this thing for free... I got a cheap solid state drive that I installed in there, so it's running really fast. But
another angle on this install Linux instead of Windows thing. Chromebooks are very inexpensive, very reliable. They're the number one computer being used in schools these days, beating out Windows in the last year. 21% of all Chromebooks are sold to schools, and I think they're a very good choice. And guess what? It's Linux. But it's a very simple version of Linux designed to just do one thing, which is run the Chrome browser, Google's Chrome browser. And then anything you want to do has to be done in the browser. It turns out most of what people do with computers these days can be done in the browser, unless you're editing movies or making music or launching rockets. And so for most people, instead of all that complexity, they just get a Chromebook. And there's some nice Chromebooks out there. But this is a new slice on this. So the Chromebook operating system is called Chromium OS. It is an open source project, but Chromium OS, the open source project, doesn't distribute downloadable, installable versions like any Linux distribution would. You can build it from scratch. You can download, because it's open source, you can download the code and build it from scratch if you know what you're doing and install it. But this company, Neverware, has decided to do that for you. So they offer a downloadable, and because it's open source, they can do this. This is kind of the nature of open source. A downloadable, installable version they call Cloud Ready. It's free for non-commercial use. If you're in a school or a business, they charge you $50 per device per year, but actually it's $25 for a school, $50 for a business. But the idea is you get support, you get addition, you know, the Google Management Console, additional stuff that a business might want. I've tried to install this on a Mac and a couple of different Macs and failed. So, but if you can get it working on a PC, and it sounds like you have, This is a great solution. You know, you run into problems. You can't do Power Wash. They don't have the Power Wash capability. That's something unique to Google's Chromebooks. But it's not such a big deal to clean it up and start over. I think this is a great choice. How long have you been using it?
Oh, just about a week or so is all.
And everything's working all right?
It is. It is so far, yeah. It boots up. I mean, before I turned it on and I went into the BIOS screen, I had nothing on it. And it seems to be working okay. There's a couple workarounds for things like Netflix and Amazon Video.
Yeah, that's an issue. So commercial stuff that wants copy protection, like Netflix, yeah, you're going to have to do something about that.
And they have a forum on there that has some answers. There's some little extension you can download to get around that.
Good. I'm pretty impressed, I have to say. I have to find a computer I can install it on so it can be more helpful. But I love this idea. I mean, it's and I wonder why Google hasn't done it, to be honest. I mean, because it's open source, they could. That, you know, Neverware can do this, and it's completely legitimate. But, yeah, that's pretty cool. And, of course, for a lot of people, the easiest would be just to buy a Chromebook. You know, and they start at $150. You said you wanted to make it lighter, and you've taken out the hard drive. That was a big start.
Yes, yeah. Well, it took it out and replaced it with an SSD, just a cheap SSD. But it's still a beast of a thing. And I'm assuming part of it's the battery. I don't know if there's anything I can do about that.
Yeah, I think you're kind of stuck with the design of it. yeah, that's an interesting question, actually. You know, you can get, they have Chrome boxes that look like like the size of a hockey puck, like a Roku or something, and they contain the Chrome OS and a PC. It's just a matter of time before you see them in sticks, like the compute stick that Intel's selling. I have one running Linux, but there's no reason why I couldn't run Chrome OS. And then you would just go plug it into a TV set via the HDMI port, and now you've got a full computer on your TV set. I mean, I feel like this is a very good way to access technology for a low price in a reliable and most importantly, secure fashion. So I'm a big supporter. I like this idea. I'm glad we could give them a plug, actually. It's neverware.com if you want to find out more. And it's free to use for non-commercial purposes. And I think for schools, a lot of schools have old, beat-up old computers that they don't know what to do with. This would be a great choice. Hey, thanks. I appreciate it, Chad.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Have a great day. I don't know how you could make it lighter. Take it apart. Put it in a smaller box. I don't know. Old computers sometimes are pretty pretty heavy and old, right? They do have a Chromebit desktop. I should have known that. They do make a stick that's a Chromebook. Of course they do. 8888 Ask Leo. More of your calls still to come. In just a second, Chris Marquardt, our photo guy. We've got some photo tips for you. Stay here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy with us, Chris Marquardt. He's our photo guy, and it's time for a photo review. Hi, Chris Marquardt.
Hi, Leo Laporte. How are you?
I am great. So what was our assignment? Because I forgot to do anything.
The assignment was sing.
The dog ate my photos. You believe that?
I don't think so, unless it ate the SD card.
Sing, S-I-N-G. So we're
sing,
looking
yeah,
for...
Yeah, it was a real tough choice this time.
Yeah, it looks like we have a lot of submissions. There's some birds singing on a tree, and there's some frogs singing. Fun. So these are all, there's a dog singing. These are all listeners who uploaded their images to our Tech Guy group on Flickr. And really some great images, I have to say. But Chris has picked three of them for special notice, special attention. We'll put a link to all of them in our show notes at techguylabs.com. So where do we start?
Well, let's start with a picture by Pixel Pusher. It's an entirely abstract picture. I have no idea how he made that. It's some contraption. He writes, it's acoustic waves modulate light with a Mark II Aero Hydraulic Interface Optical Computer.
Sure. That sounds like he's making up words. That's making up words, I think. But it looks beautiful.
Possibly. But it just, I don't know, it just, it has something very organic to it. I think that's why I like it. It looks like it is really kind of a projection onto a surface, then photographed. And just beautiful shapes and colors. Looks a bit like bokeh, but with much harder edges. So it's got a photographic context. And, I mean, he kind of shoehorned this into the Sing theme by writing "Sing, I can't carry a tune in a time bubble."
it's
really something that gets your imagination going. Could be a science fiction story there or something.
This is important, though. You don't have to. I think we always think of photos as representational. They could
doesn't
be
have
abstract.
To be literal.
Yeah, yeah, they could be abstract.
That's a good example for that.
This would be beautiful enough to print up and put on the wall. I think. I love it.
Definitely. Yeah. The colors are beautiful on that one. The next one, you could print that out and put it up on a wall. It's by our moderator, Renee Silverman.
Oh, Renee, nice job. Look at that.
It's a photo of a singer on stage, apparently, with there's a red light coming from above. You don't see the light source. All you see is the light as it, kind of the volume light that you see in stage haze or smoke. And it just, I like it for its simplicity. I like it for the fact that the singer is actually looking outside of the frame, which is kind of unusual.
Composition is what makes this, right? And, you know, I think if you're taking a picture of a singer, you're tempted just to take it head on as, you know, full face. And I love it that she has the singer on the side of the picture with the light showing down from
approach.
The right.
It's a very different approach.
I love it.
It's really nice. I mean, it's in focus. It's sharp. The exposure is spot on. The thing I'm not too keen on is the big copyright logo in the right bottom. That kind of puts me off a bit. Pulls too much attention towards it. So it pulls attention away from the singer in the photo. But you can actually, that's one where that you could actually use some clone stamp and just take it out because it's on a black background.
Yeah, be easy.
Not
to
that
remove.
I would ever do that.
But I would just, you know, and I understand why Renee does this. This is very challenging for all photographers. When you put your image on the internet, it's very hard to protect it. I mean, it's, you know, and in fact, this is still going to be hard to protect because, as you say, it'd be easy enough to get rid of it.
If someone has a nefarious reason, wants to steal the picture, they will easily clone out that copyright.
We just have to accept the notion that the value of posting a picture, sharing it, getting feedback on it, getting people to see your stuff outweighs the risk that it'll be stolen. And you just kind of have to accept it, right?
For me, it does. And I regularly find some of my pictures somewhere. And I actually on Flickr, I put most of my pictures under a Creative Commons license. So it's okay to use them. It's okay to put them on people to put them on blogs. I don't allow commercial usage of the stuff.
Flickr
so if someone
lets you,
prints.
Flickr has a tool that will let you say what rights you want. And they have you can choose Creative Commons rights. And I would guess you do what I do, which is you can use this for non-commercial purposes, but you have to give me credit.
That's exactly the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that usually works out quite well. And
people
it brings people
that.
Back to my pictures.
Yeah, I think it's worth
so
it.
So number three by Josh Brown, Jamming.
Oh, I like this.
That's a very creative sort of picture. So what Josh did is he attached a camera to the head of his guitar. And in a way that it's looking down down over the neck of the guitar, and you can see his hand on there and his leg and then some part of the room, but everything in the shot is blurred, kind of a circular blur. So what he did is he moved the guitar with the camera attached to the guitar so the guitar stays in focus and everything else gets blurred out. And that just creates this swirl around the guitar with the guitar in focus in the middle. Kind of, it's like concentric circles around the guitar, and that really draws the attention there. And he also used a pretty wide-angle lens there, so it gives the head of the guitar some additional visual weight.
This is a very creative, clever idea, isn't it? Just to put it right on the top of the guitar there. I love that.
And he didn't even use any big guitar. It's a GoPro. It's a small action cam, pretty much. And those GoPro cameras, those action cameras have fairly wide-angle lenses, so it really lends itself to the purpose of that, attaching it to things, and then when you move things, they will be in focus. And I guess he did a longer exposure time by just doing this in a bit of a darker room, so the camera would automatically expose a bit longer and get the motion in there.
That's one of the advantages of these smaller action cameras, is you can put them like on your head or on a guitar or all sorts of interesting places. And I think one of the reasons
it's really easy to get creative with these kind of cameras. You can put them in a waste basket and have them look at you, or inside the fridge, or tie them to the back of your dog and have that run around and film video. It's really fun to step outside of that convention of having to hold a camera in front of your eyes and look through the viewfinder.
I'm really realizing that creativity sometimes can be a mechanical thing. Just, you know, having a drone or a action camera can give you an opportunity to do something different and be more creative just by the mechanics of having something different to use. Tilt-shift camera, you know, those tilt-shift lenses or a film
camera. New toys can be a real boost for your creativity, for sure. Absolutely.
Now, Chris Marquardt is all about the toys, but he's also all about the art, and you can find his work, his podcast, Tips from the Top Floor, his book, a beautiful book on film photography, the Film Photography Handbook, and lots more about his workshops at discoverthetopfloor.com. That's his website. And I think you're heading out, aren't you? We're going to record some pieces for the next couple of weeks. Where are you going?
I'm going to Norway, to the Lofoten. That's a group of islands in Norway, up during the midnight sun. So we'll
so jealous.
Have beautiful light all around the clock.
I want to see the midnight sun. Well, I'm sure you'll take pictures back. Is there a trick to taking pictures? Because they're not. I hear it's not that bright, the midnight sun, or is it?
Well, you probably have longer exposures. The tripod will probably help.
Yeah.
So that's what I will do. I will bring a tripod and maybe a remote release. By the way, we have a new assignment.
Oh, yes. What are we going to do?
And it's one that I've never really thought of, but it makes perfect sense here. Technology.
Well, I'll have to explain how you participate, and in about a month we'll review those pictures. Thank you, Chris Marquardt. Have fun in Norway.
Sure.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Stay here. Are you doing a workshop in Norway, or are you just going for fun?
Oh, that's nice. It's a group of 10 photographers. We'll spend a good week there.
That'll be fun.
Oh, it'll be amazing. Lofoten is look it up, Lofoten. Look up pictures of the Lofoten on Flickr, and you'll understand.
Nice.
It's beautiful there.
It's not going to be freezing either, because you're in... Oh, look at this. I like that. All the Twit podcasts. Lofoten.
Lofoten.
L-E-F-O-T-E-N?
L-O. Lofoten. Lofoten.
Lofoten. Lofoten. Ooh. Yeah, Norway looks a lot like that.
it's got the fjords, it's got the mountains,
you got the dried
it's got
the fish.
Sea. It's got
this looks a lot like Kristiansund, where we went for the Northern Lights photo festival.
Oh yeah, very very similar. Yeah, absolutely,
very very similar. It's
beautiful seascapes, reflections.
Look at that.
Well, no Northern Lights. Well, there will be, but we won't see them because the sun is going to be up all the time.
Oh, that's you're going the wrong time of year.
Oh. Yeah, but you can get up at 3 a.m. and take sunset pictures.
That's right. The magic hour is about 8 hours. Yeah.
It's all around the clock. It's always there.
Wow. This looks
all
great.
All you have to do is be there.
Oh, I'm looking forward to seeing your pictures. This will be great.
Beautiful. Oh, yeah. That's my first time there, so I'm. This is a childhood dream.
Now, is there somebody hosting you, or are you just going?
No, we have a local operator who kind of organizes things for us. And
nice.
Take a group, and we have cars to move around, and it's easy to get around there.
Neat.
And we'll take some boat rides through the fjords and go to pretty much... you can pretty much stop anywhere you like and have amazing photo ops there.
I don't think I'm ever going to get Lisa back to Norway, though.
Oh. Eh. Too bad.
Yeah. I didn't enjoy it that much. I don't know why.
Too much fish?
Yeah. I think the food and I think the... I don't know, not the climate exactly. Oh, it's very far north. Wow.
It is, yeah.
It's way up here.
Yep.
Wow.
Almost Arctic.
Neato. Well, have a wonderful time.
Well, we'll do. We'll talk after you've finished the show today. We have two pre-recordings.
Yep. I envy you because living in Germany, these places are so close. I mean, this for me would be like going to Vancouver or something. I mean, it's just up the road a piece, practically. It's what, it's an hour and a half, 2 hour flight, something like that?
Slightly longer. It's got more legs because the...
Oh, yeah. Nobody goes direct to Lofoten.
Getting there is a bit of an ordeal. Yeah. I will actually have to take... The last bit is going to be a ferry, a three and a half hour ferry ride.
Oh, you take the Hurtigruten.
The Hurtigruten, exactly.
Yeah, we took the Hurtigruten. Yes. That was the last straw for Lisa. We were here.
I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, I love the Hurtigruten. We were up here in Kristiansund, so we weren't so far away.
We'll have to work something out and put Lisa up in a place where she can be for a week and have fun.
She would have liked Oslo. She would have loved Bergen. So we took the Hurtigruten, which is a boat all the way around to Bergen.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And then took a train from Bergen to Oslo. It's right through the...
Oh, that's a fun ride, too. That I must loved be beautiful it. Landscape
Lisa
there.
Did not enjoy it particularly. And Catherine Hall was with us. She didn't like it that much either. They both got a little seasick on the Hurtigruten. And then the train was a long, like, 8-hour train trip. They weren't that. Anyway. Hey, I got a ride. I'll talk to you after the show.
Talk to you later.
Thanks, Chris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Phone number is 8888-ASK. Leo, if you want to participate in our assignment, our photo assignment, it's not a contest. It's just for fun. There's no prizes. But it's really an excuse to go out and take pictures. Chris is using the word, phrase, concept, technology. So we don't want to be too specific, that whatever that means to you. And remember, a zipper was technology to people who had only seen buttons. So it could be, it's just a variety. I think the definition of technology is something that wasn't invented when you were born. So take an image, a picture of technology. It doesn't have to be with a fancy camera. It could be with anything. A camera phone's just fine. But you get to upload one a week to Flickr. You can upload all you want to Flickr, but tag it with the word technology and then submit one a week to our tech guy group. Renee Silverman, the moderator there. You'll know it's the right group. It's a picture of me, and I think we have, I don't know, 11,000 members, something like that. So submit it to the tech guy group. We'll honor all of you, but pick three of them for Chris to talk about a month. Again, the assignment is technology. Back to the phones, Chris in Los Angeles. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Leo. My name is Chris. I'm rebuilding a house in Southern California, and one of the things that I'd like to deploy is home automation in the home.
And
there's a really high-end, Crestion and Control 4 and that type of thing available. But then there's also obviously the Amazon and,
right.
the less expensive stuff.
Right.
But part of me wants to go hardwired, but it seems like the less expensive stuff, which fits my budget, doesn't really, support hardwired systems. So I'm kind of curious about home automation, your experience with it, first of all, and then also the security of it, because I got kids and, they're going to be going to high school at some point and, kids being kids, they can hack and do whatever.
The problem we have right now is that you're in at the very beginning. I know it seems like we've been talking about home automation for a couple of decades, and we have. Crestron's been around for a long time, but we're just still at the very infancy of this. And one of the reasons it's difficult to give you recommendations is there just a lot of different standards. There hasn't been any kind of coalescing on a single standard, an agreement about what how it should work. So that's problem number one. Almost all the home automation systems I see, the modern ones, are wireless. Nobody's building a wired home system now. Those wired ones are the older ones, the Crestrons and the like, that have been around for a long time. Wireless is so pervasive, and almost everybody has Wi-Fi, and it's easy to add more devices because they're not wired. So I know you're building the house, and a lot of people will say, well, I got the walls open, I'm going to build the house. What should I put in there? I guess future-proofing it would probably be a good idea to put not any particular kind of wire in there, but put conduit in a tunnel so that you could pull other wire if you wanted to at some point. Because, you know, anybody who put in Cat 5 10 years ago is now thinking, wow, I wish I'd put fiber in there. And, you know, if you didn't put conduit in, something you could pull new wires through, you don't have that option. I don't think anything you do, I really think wireless is the way to go. I also wouldn't make a massive investment into a single platform because we don't know who the winner is going to be. Is it going to be Apple? Is it going to be Google? Is it going to be Zigbee? Or is it going to be, Z-Wave? Or is it going to be SmartThings, Samsung's solution? There's too many, and there's no agreement. And the worst is, you know, you get, let's say you get home automation locks, you know, locks that open up as you get close, they see your phone via Bluetooth. They may use one protocol, but your thermostat may use another. And, it's just a mess right now. You also raise a very important issue, which is security. Once you put these things on your network, and to be useful, they have to be on your network. The Nest thermostat and the Ratio sprinkler systems and the Crestron locks, they all have to be on your internet so that they can do things. You know, the Ratio knows what the weather is, so it doesn't water your lawn if it's going to rain. The Nest thermostat knows how hot it is outside, so it knows how to control your temperature in your home. Those things are valuable, but they're also potential security issues, and we've seen a number of these crop up, particularly with cameras, baby monitors and security cameras, often don't protect themselves very well, so strangers can come in and look at your cameras over the internet. There's a bigger risk, which is that anything that's on your internet could be a gateway into your network from a bad guy sitting on the street. And the worst risk of all, we've seen this with some security systems, is radio jammers can disable the entire security system. That's one reason not to use wireless for a security system, by the way. Bad guys can now buy a $20 radio jammer, jam your security system, walk in the door, rob you blind and leave, and you'll be none the wiser because the whole system is jammed. So I guess my answer to you is I don't know. It's early days yet. We really are not close to knowing what the winner is going to be and what to do. I think at the stage where it's very much for the hobbyist and somebody who's willing to spend a lot of time messing around with it. And there is no single standard.
Right. So getting back to the wireless side, it sounds like you're kind of leaning toward the wireless in the future.
Wireless is a huge convenience, but it's also a risk.
So do you think that I should, I'll pull conduit tunnels to all the televisions and that type of thing?
I would do that.
I should also to the power plugs as well, or do you think that those?
No, I think you're going to be wireless. I think any reasonable solution will be wireless. And that's fine because we know what needs to be done to make these secure. They can be made secure. It's just that up to now, the companies that have made this stuff are kind of no-name Chinese companies that have no interest or care or even knowledge about security, and they're just cranking stuff out. And so we did on our Security Now show, we did an episode on baby monitors last week. And even Philips, even the giant Dutch conglomerate Philips, is putting out a baby monitor that anybody can use to look into your bedroom. I mean, there's just no security on it. So they're not doing a very good job. I think home automation will not take off until we know it's secure, for one thing. But when it does, it will be wireless. And wireless can be made secure. It's not inherently insecure. But it does present a risk if it's not.
So it sounds like you personally probably don't have door locks that are automated.
No. No, I've thought about it. And in the past, I had the Nest thermostat, and I have Hue lights, and I have a SmartThings hub and SmartThings sensors. And over time, as I've moved, I've just not put them back in again. I just didn't find them that useful. It's kind of gimmicky right now, to be honest. I think for right now, I wouldn't worry about a massive home automation. I mean, if you wanted to, you know, very, very wealthy people will put in, for instance, Crestron, so you can push a button and the movie screen comes down in your home theater and the curtains close, the lights dim, the music comes up, and the popcorn starts popping. As you saw, I'm sure if you priced it, it's very expensive. Yeah. And it's kind of limited. I mean, I think that's all it does. Will it talk to other devices? No. You know, and the dream of home automation is a ways off. It's kind of Jetsons era still.
Gotcha.
That's my opinion. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Internet of Things, which is the kind of another way of describing this, which is everything will have an internet connection, will for sure be wireless. No one's going to wire up their refrigerator, their microwave, their toaster, their thermostat, their plug sockets. Nobody's going to do that. It's going to be all wireless. But we've got to solve these security issues around it. It's challenging because you're building the house now, and you're probably going to be in there for 20 years or 30, whatever. And, you know, in 20 years, will this be different? Yeah, the landscape will have changed dramatically. What will it look like? I have no idea. I don't think anybody does. Anybody who's telling you they know what it's going to be is rooting for a technology as opposed to knowing that it will succeed. We're going to take a break. Hour number three of the Tech Guy Show, still to come. Lots more to talk about. Stay right here. I forgot one thing that I do still use, and I will install everywhere. Speaking of Internet of Things, is this Ring video doorbell. Our show today brought to you by Ring. And this is the one, I haven't put the Hue lights back up. I didn't put the Nest back up, but this is the one thing I won't live without. Here's the idea. This doorbell, it connects to your Wi-Fi, replaces your existing doorbell, wired or not, by the way. It's got a big battery in it, so you can also use it where there is no wired doorbell. I like that. And the Ring video doorbell has a camera, wide-angle camera on it. It's got a speaker on it, a microphone. And when somebody rings the doorbell, it will ring not just in my house, but everywhere on my phone, on my tablet, on my Mac. I can see who's there. I can see the video. It's got motion detection, so it will actually send me video even when somebody doesn't ring the doorbell. We got a great Ring of Security kit for you right now. I love this idea. If you've been intrigued by the Ring video doorbell, you get the Ring video doorbell for the front door, a Ring stick-up cam, which is a wireless, weatherproof HD camera you can put anywhere on your property so you can keep an eye on the back as well as the front, for instance. And you get a solar panel, so that keeps the Ring camera working even without power. And the chime, which is nice because, yeah, sure, right now your doorbell, you press the button, it rings one spot in your house, but the chime can be plugged in anywhere there's an outlet, and it can ring there too. Yeah, so the whole thing, the video doorbell, the stick-up cam, the solar panel, and the chime in our Ring of Security kit. I love this. And you're going to save $50 off of it if you go to ring.com/tech guy. But even if you don't want the whole kit, you're going to really want the Ring video doorbell. I love this thing. R-I-N-G, ring.com/tech guy to get $50 off our Ring of Security kit. Protect your home, your family, and gosh, I keep meaning to send this to my mom. She's 83. She doesn't want to go get the doorbell if it's not somebody it's not something she wants. This would be a lifesaver. She just sits there. She can talk to them. They ring the doorbell. She says, "I'm not interested. Go away." Or, "I'll be there. Give me a minute. I'm a little slow." This is a lifesaver. And, you know, I can get my nephew, Will, who just graduated from high school. He can install it. It's easy peasy. ring.com/tech guy. Mom, I'm one in the mail, I promise. I've been meaning to do this for a while. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to take some calls, talk about tech, whether it's computers or the internet or your home theater, your smartphone, your smartwatch, digital photography. 8888 Ask Leo. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside that area, you could just call via Skype. 888-827-5536. We write everything down on the website, so you don't have to. That's TechEyeLabs.com. TechEyeLabs.com. And now we go to Jim in Los Angeles. Hello, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. I've got a Lenovo Ultrabook
And I get this message all the time that the battery is charged to a high capacity and it's adverse health, adverse to the battery's health, above 70%.
Oh, that's BS. Okay. Is that a program Lenovo puts on there?
Yep.
Such BS. So there's a lot of
say that, but I want to make sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of mythology about lithium ion batteries, and most of it is garbage. And what surprises me is that some of it, a lot of it, comes from companies that make the equipment that's using the lithium ion battery. So here's what you need to know. That's all you need to know about lithium ion batteries. They have a certain number of charge cycles. A charge cycle is all the way up and all the way down. Typically around 500. If you charge it halfway, that's half of one. So that's full charge all the way up, all the way down. Fractional charges, you know, count, but they add up. So that's the life of the battery. After that, it's just not going to charge anymore. Although they seem to have discovered what the issue is on that, and has to do with little nanowires connecting the cells, and they've at least in the lab, they found a way to coat those nanowires so that those batteries never wear out, or they don't wear out for years and years, which would be wonderful. So I think that's going to be fixed. Not yet. Not yet. It was a great discovery, though, just a couple of months ago. But that's what happens, is the micro wires that are connecting them apparently just degenerate, and after a time won't carry current anymore, and you can't charge.
You would get a 1,050% cycle.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Very good. Your math is excellent.
Terrific.
And that's, you know, that's typically a few years, right? For a phone, for a laptop, whatever, that's a few years. And that's really what we see. And then what happens when those batteries fail is they just don't, you can't charge them. They decline very, very rapidly. And you just won't get any more charge cycles out of them. They'll work a little bit, and then they'll stop working. In between, if you want to maintain your lithium-ion batteries, there's nothing really to do. Just know that you have a certain number of cycles. It doesn't matter if you charge at 100%. Any well-made piece of hardware will prevent you from overcharging. Now, overcharging lithium-ion battery is not just bad for the battery, but could be bad for you because they do explode. So remember the problem people were having with those hoverboards bursting into flame? Well, that was overcharging, and that's because the charging circuitry, was improperly made. But not on a Lenovo laptop, not on anything that's well-made. Your phone from any reputable manufacturer has overcharge protection. It's not going to overcharge. You'll see also some devices, and I don't think this is a good idea, but some devices will kind of go up and down. They'll discharge, recharge. I don't think that's a good idea. That's using up, even fractionally, using up your total cycles.
So if I leave it plugged in most of the time, the battery could last years.
Best thing to do, leave it plugged in. If you're going to store it, that's advice number one, leave it plugged in. Don't discharge and recharge it unnecessarily. Sometimes people will say, I think because of nickel metal hydride and nickel cadmium batteries, you need to discharge it and recharge it. No, you don't. I've seen some evidence, a little risk if you fully discharge lithium ion batteries. Probably not good to like really let it die. But again, circuitry will not let you do that on a well-made device. Final piece of advice, if you're storing it, store it half charged. That's it. Okay. Keep it plugged in. Don't worry about 70%. I can't even believe that Lenovo put software on there that says that. That's something they should handle. And really what they're avoiding and what they should be avoiding is the explosion caused by overcharging, period. That's baffling to me that they put that on there.
Great. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. I appreciate the call. I'm glad you asked that. Somebody in the chat room saying, no, it shouldn't be at constantly 100%. That's not good for it. Well, I'd like to see the evidence of that. It is true that a lot of chargers will do a little bit, let it go down and go up and go down and go up. I don't think that's to protect the battery. I think that's just because that's how they are. But I'd love to see your evidence for that. Here's what I know to be true based on good, solid research. You got a limited number of charge cycles. Don't discharge and recharge unnecessarily. The best thing for a battery is to keep it plugged in all the time because then you're not using those cycles up. If you're going to store it at 50%. That's all. Anything else is made up, is folklore. And there's a lot of it for some reason. Alan in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Alan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
It's going great. How are you?
I'm good. Listen, I've got a 2015 XPS 13, and I use a Plantronics Blackwire C320 headset on it. And recently, Windows 10 decided to stop recognizing the driver altogether. Wow. So when I plug it in, it just does not show up in Device Manager. It tells me that the driver is corrupted. But the driver is a generic Windows driver.
So let me ask you about this Plantronics. And, where does it plug in? Is it USB?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's USB. Exactly.
So it's a USB microphone and headphone.
Yes.
And it's true that there probably isn't a dedicated Plantronics driver for that, unless Plantronics wants to add additional features. You know, sometimes you get a Logitech mouse and they'll say, oh, you need to use the Logitech driver. It's not a driver. That's sure. Just software, because all computers come with the ability to use those headsets without any additional driver. All it's doing is it's a USB audio device.
Right.
So I'm not sure what's wrong. It is possible that the USB, the generic USB driver has been corrupted, although it seems unlikely.
So I was able to boot it into Ubuntu to continue the Linux theme of today's show.
And how did it work?
It was fine.
It worked fine.
It worked just fine.
Thank you. Thank you, Microsoft. Thank you. A tip of the hat. Once again, quality work.
Exactly. So I...
By the way, that is a great diagnostic tip, something only a real geek would do. But if you happen to have a Linux Live CD lying around, boot into that. Because then you'll know it's the software. It's not the hardware. It's not the Plantronics. It's not the hardware on the computer, because it works with some other operating system. So there's something wrong with Windows 10.
And so I tried to blow away the drive, reinstall Windows 10.
Oh.
Same thing happened.
Well... It's some weird incompatibility with Windows 10 and that Plantronics headset. I would go to the Plantronics site and see what they say, see if they have any advice for using it with Windows 10. That's pretty annoying, because it really should. You know, a USB audio is just a kind of a standard thing. It's an audio sound card that uses USB. It's not complicated. Sure. In fact, what we recommend, we use those Plantronic headsets all the time. And I have not encountered issues, but I'm guessing a lot of our... correspondents don't use Windows 10 yet, so this may be a Windows 10 issue. You can remove the you just go to the Device Manager, remove the USB hub and USB devices, and let it plug and play, reinstall those. Maybe they are damaged. It's interesting, though, that in a brand new fresh install, same problem. That tells me there's a compatibility issue between the Plantronics headset and whatever Windows 10 is providing, and that's on Microsoft. I would go to the Plantronics site if they have forums, see if others are having this problem. There may be a fix. You did a very smart thing, though. You tried it with a different operating system, and it worked fine. Thank you, Microsoft. Tip of the hat. Job well done. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. What's this thing they're advertising on CNN's Solo Shot? Where is my... I'm supposed to have that... I ordered that camera that from... Maybe they're not getting it working. The one that they showed, Mark Zuckerberg showed in the Facebook event, that's supposed to... your personal robot cameraman. Oh. How could that possibly work? Seems kind of clunky. Are you wearing something? How does it keep you in the shot? Oh, you wear the tag, and the base automatically pan, tilts, and zooms. I suppose I'm going to have to buy this just to see if it actually works. And how... Oh! Ow! $473! Ow! Ow! $710! Yeah, no. They want to send me one for review, maybe. Wow, that's expensive. And that's with a discount. I need it for... No, see, because I got the other one. What's that one from Livestream? I ordered it. The Mevo. That's the one I got. But I've ordered it, but it hasn't come. But that was a lot less expensive, I think. We saw them at NAB. He said, oh, I'm going to get, make sure you get yours soon. Well, best camera CES. That's funny. That was 6 months ago. Where's my Mima? Oh, it says it's filming you. That's funny. Anybody try it? Oh, Xbox One S. Paul seemed like he knew something and he couldn't talk about it. Ooh, 2 terabyte. Well, I already have a 3 terabyte external on my... Oh, it's just a white Xbox One. I'm probably going to have to get the PS4.5 or whatever that is. Ooh, 40% smaller. 4K video. HDR. Ooh. See, if I get that new TV, I have to get this to go with it. Ooh. Will it support the new UHD DVD Blu-ray disc, though? Probably not. Hmm. I'm going to get the PS4.5 with the VR. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo. Let's see here. Russ in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Hello, Russ.
Hello. How you doing, Leo?
I am well. Welcome to the show.
Long time watcher and listener.
Well, thank you. What can I do for you?
Yeah, I want your advice on what VR system to buy. Should I get the Oculus Rift or should I get the Vive?
Now, I have both the Rift and the Vive, but I've also played with the one I think might be the winner, which is the Sony PlayStation VR.
Really?
That's not out yet, and I'm not sure when that will be out. They have only said sometime this fall, probably in time for the holiday buying season. But, you know, E3, the gaming conference, starts tomorrow, and there will be press conferences tonight and tomorrow, and I would watch the Sony press conference for hints. I'll tell you what, they're all very similar. It may end up coming down to what games are available. What do you want to do with your VR headset?
Well, we run a business, and I want to put it in our window of our business as people are walking by to let them come in and play it.
Ah, just like kind of an attraction.
Exactly.
I think the Vive would be the best for that, and I'll tell you why. The Vive comes, this is the one from HTC. It comes with, unlike the Oculus, which does not yet have the paddles, it doesn't have any hand controls. Both the PlayStation VR and the Vive have paddles. That makes a big difference. The Oculus Rift, you just get a visor, so all you could do is look around, and you'll use a game controller to move around and stuff like that. But that is not as interesting as with the paddles, because with the paddles you can fight, you can move your hands, you can do all sorts of interesting things. The other thing the Vive does that's interesting, the Oculus Rift comes with a camera, but you can't move too much. So it's good if you have a limited space to do this. But since you've got a business, you could mark off maybe a 10-foot square area.
Yeah.
And that's what the Vive will let you do. They put cameras, 2 cameras, in each corner, about 6.5 feet tall. And then the player can put on the headsets, strap on the paddles, and move around in that 10-foot square area. And the cameras will have your exact precise position. That makes it more fun. For instance, there's a game on the Vive where you're standing kind of on the deck of a spaceship and flying saucers keep coming at you. And you can move around, you can duck, you can dodge, you can weave. And it's a very vivid experience because of that. The Oculus Rift doesn't let you do quite as much. So right now, if it's a choice between the Rift and the Vive, I'd say the Vive. The Rift might have better games. This is the funny thing, because the Vive's teamed up with Steam, which is the PC gaming platform. But I've yet to see any really compelling Vive games. Maybe that's, both of them are brand new. Maybe that's coming. I'm really...
They're waiting.
Then that's one of the reasons, for my home purposes, I'm kind of interested in the PlayStation VR. It's going to be less expensive. If you have a PlayStation 4, you'd be a lot less expensive. You can use the Move paddles that already are out, and those are become your paddles for the PlayStation VR. But it's mostly designed for sitting down or staying in a single place. And as a business, you might prefer that because you may not want the liability of having people stumble around inside your business and potentially hurt themselves. So the PlayStation VR is mostly sitting down. It's a very compelling experience, though. The one I played, I'm sitting in a car. You know, you kind of like wake up and you're in a car and you're driving down the 405 and you look to your right and there's a guy kind of looks like, I know, Jason Statham, you know, he's kind of like the gangster type. And he says, yeah, we got to watch out for those Russian mobsters. And you say, what do you mean? And all of a sudden, one comes flying by on a motorcycle. He pulls out a gun. He shoots him. The guy hits the windshield. You dodge, breaks the windshield. And it feels like you're there. And you open the glove compartment. There's bullets in the glove compartment. And now it's like a shooting game where you're trying to defend yourself against Russian mobsters in SUVs and motorcycles. It was very compelling. It was really fun. Now, one thing you should be aware of with all three systems, less so with one where you're sitting down, is nausea. Now, it may attract customers, but you don't want to make them throw up. And every single one of these systems has that as a potential problem for a percentage of its users. Maybe not all of them, but maybe, but a significant portion will get queasy after a few minutes.
And give them a good instructions.
Yeah, I think the sitting down, I'm thinking the PlayStation VR, but if you need it now, I would say the Vive. The Vive is the most elaborate of all the experiences. It's also the most expensive, and it's pretty amazing. Yeah. And yet, it's you know, my wife, for instance, she puts these things on, she gets nauseous in a minute or two.
Really?
I don't think that's unusual. I think at least 10%, maybe 20% of the population is going to get queasy using any of these. And that may not be the best advertisement for your business. I like the idea, though, getting people to come in and come on in and play the VR. Because it's so new, that could be a great attraction. So, you know, even the Oculus Rift would be fun. You don't move around quite as much. Maybe that would help a little bit. We do that, by the way. When people come by in the studio, we offer them a chance to play with the Vive or the Rift. Now, if your business is selling Dramamine, Heather Hammond's got the right idea. Yeah. The other thing somebody told me who does flight simulators for the Air Force is a cold wash rag on the back of your neck. Just get a little ice water bucket there, fold up a nice wash rag, put it on the back of your neck. Apparently that cures it. I did not know that. That's fun. I have mixed feelings whether this is going to be the next big thing or just another gimmick. I'm not sure one way or the other. It's pretty cool. On the other hand, I don't see myself spending hours wearing one of those visors. Let's see. We're running a little out of time on this segment, but I'll start with David, and we'll see how far we can get. Long Beach, California. Hi, David.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I had a question. My landlord projects a very weak Wi-Fi signal, and she doesn't want to get an extender. So I was wondering, is there something that I could do to improve that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, you have to get a sending and receiving. You know, you have to do both. Because just as it's hard to get her signal, it's hard to get it back to her access point. Let me take a break because we have to, but when we come back, I'll tell you how you can improve your Wi-Fi signal fairly easily. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, let me show you my Ratio. This would be a good time to do that. Our sponsor on the show today. Where did I put it? Here it is. Oh, this is such a good idea. So there are, as I said, there are some things. Overall home automation still has a way to go, but there's some things that are just naturals for taking advantage of the Internet of Things. And this is one of them, Ratchio, R-A-C-H-I-O, Home Smart Sprinkler Controller. The idea is if your sprinkler system knew it was going to rain, it would not water your garden, things like that. They save a lot of water on these Ratchios. In fact, I think at the bottom of the website, rachio.com/twit, they have, over a billion gallons of water saved. So it's easy to set up. It uses iOS or Android. And you know what? It's the kind of thing you can do yourself. I have, this is the ratio here. If you can have it indoors, they also have an enclosure that you can put it outdoors. The wires are already, you know, there with your existing sprinkler system. You just reconnect them here, right? They come through here, reconnect them. It even has the traditional timer and on-off thing, so you don't have to set up the initial manual operation with your smartphone. But you want to get the app, and you want to connect this to Wi-Fi, because then, ooh, cool stuff happens. You can connect it with your Nest, your Alexa. You can, yeah, you can actually say to your Echo, water the lawn or stop watering the lawn. Your Control 4, your eye control. You can run zones right here directly from the controller, giving you or your landscaper access manually. You also have LED lights, which you can't see because they're not on here, but they let you know which zone is doing it. This one is a 16-zone unit. They also, I think, make an 8-zone unit. It's such a good idea. They also have a network of local weather stations, so you can tune your watering schedule to the local weather, not just the Weather Service's generalized weather, but to the weather in your neighborhood. Using Ratio's weather intelligence, it automatically adjusts your schedules for weather events, so you don't have to worry about turning it off or on. You'll even get alerts whenever Ratio steps in to adjust schedules for rain. And because it saves so much water, your local water company probably will give you a rebate. We were talking to somebody, where were you, Pasadena or Glendale somewhere, where the whole thing cost them like $30 because you got such a big rebate. Rebate's up to 100% of the cost of the controller from your local water provider. Plus, you're going to save up to 50% on your outdoor watering bill. And you're going to save, they've now a billion gallons of water saved, which is so awesome, especially here in California. Ratio, R-A-C-H-I-O. .com/twit. Easy to install, easy to set up, and it works great. Ratio.com/twit. Change the way you water. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The Facebook folks just announced yesterday, I think, or Friday, that they're going to support 360-degree video in Facebook. You just take a picture with your 360-degree cam or video and upload it. And then people who are wearing virtual reality visors like Google Cardboard or the Gear VR from Samsung or even the HTC Vive or the Oculus Rift can immerse themselves in your pictures on Facebook. That sounds nightmarish. Awkward family photos take a whole new meaning. I'm there with you. Facebook owns Oculus, the makers of the Oculus Rift, and so they're going to probably do a lot more of this VR stuff. I'm still not convinced whether this is going to be huge or not. Anyway, let's get back to David. He's on the line from Long Beach. This is a common problem. Landlady has Wi-Fi, but doesn't want to improve the strength of her Wi-Fi signal, which means you're sitting out in the back there and you can hardly see it. Or how many bars do you get?
2 to 3.
Yeah. Is it real slow?
Yeah, it is, and sometimes it just drops.
Yeah. Well, you can, and I'll send you to, there are a couple of places you can get, you know, you can at least look at Wi-Fi antennas that will improve your signal. They're mostly directional. Your best bet, of course, would be to try to talk the landlady into putting the access point somewhere closer to a window, for instance, because that's going to be do a better job than you improving your reception. Radiolabs.com is a site devoted to this exact thing, to improving Wi-Fi signals in places where it's not very good using external antennas. And they make two kinds. They make directional antennas, which is probably what you'd want because you're going to aim it towards wherever that access point is. You have to figure out where that is, that just where the strongest signal is. And there's also omnidirectional that would help if you had the access point and you wanted to spread it around to a large area. So you're probably going to get a directional antenna. They have them that connect via USB, and they come out of the back of your computer. The best ones, are you on a laptop?
Yeah, laptop and cell phone.
Yeah, nope. Yeah. See, this won't help your cell phone at all. The best ones actually connect directly to the Wi-Fi card, which means poking a hole in your laptop. If you had a desktop, it wouldn't be a big deal. You can get USB Wi-Fi adapters, And that would give you the best chance at improving the signal. And you can even get them long enough so you could put it in the window. Or I bet it works better when you're, you know, in some places than others, right?
What works better, though?
Your Wi-Fi signal, is it stronger in some areas of your apartment? Or
yeah, if I move closer to where the
router. Yeah, so that's, you know, sometimes you can put a antenna there. And, you know, there's no real good solution to this, to be honest with you. I'm sorry to say. The best solution would be to try to... I mean, you can go to Radio Labs and look, and you'll see. And they have a lot of help and information there. But the best thing to do would be see if you can get the landlady to improve the situation. You know, and sometimes it's... you can do that by saying, hey, you know, I'd love to help you secure this Wi-Fi a little bit better, things like that. You should get a password on it. I bet she doesn't have one. There are ways to...
She does.
She does. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Too bad. She's smart. Oh, well. Yeah, I don't know of... There are companies like Eero, E-E-R-O, and there's a new one called Luma, L-U-M-A, that are designed to distribute Wi-Fi better using something called WDS, the Wireless Distribution System. And the way those work is by using intermediate Wi-Fi adapters. So Wi-Fi access point, landlady's house, and then halfway between you and the landlady's house, you could put a Wi-Fi extender, and that will improve your signal. Are you at a separate building or are you in the same building?
Separate.
Yeah. So that means probably be outside, which is not, just not a good place to put a Wi-Fi extender. But that's one way to do something like that. And certainly a lot of people with large homes or difficult homes because they have multiple floors or they might have metal in the walls can use devices like this. The Eero is extremely expensive, and I tried it in my home and wasn't able to get very good results with it. So I can't really recommend it. But it's using a technology I think that we're going to see more and more of that's designed to help you get better Wi-Fi access in more distant points. You could also offer to buy her a new Wi-Fi router. She probably has an old one. A newer one, if you got 802.11ac, the newest standard, will give you much better distance and much stronger signal. So if you said to her, hey, you know, I'd love to help you out with a newer Wi-Fi router that would help me and help you, I would recommend, for instance, the Asus ASUS C3200. That thing goes miles. That thing really is much more powerful than the one. She's probably using the one that her internet service provider gave her. And those are not very good. So that's another way you can maybe talk her into improving the situation. I'd like to buy you a new router. It would help everybody. You'd be more secure, and I'd have a little bit better Wi-Fi out back here. It just, you know, it helps. It would be best to get her cooperation. It's very hard to do this just on your end, I guess, is the answer. Bob in Las Vegas, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. Welcome. What can I do for you?
Good, good, good. Well, I've got a problem. I've got a older, receiver, AV receiver, and I've got a pair of headphones that I love that are wired, but I'd rather not run either of them wired. I'm looking for like a transceiver for the AV receiver. It would send Bluetooth to some sort of unit that I could then plug in this pair of headphones that I have on that I really love, but they're not Bluetooth.
Yeah, so you need both.
Making it Bluetooth.
Both ends would have to have Bluetooth. You'd have to have a Bluetooth transmitter on your AV receiver, and you'd have to have a Bluetooth receiver that you plug the headphones into. Certainly that can be done, and there are definitely a lot of companies that sell these. They tend to be kind of cheap Chinese, you know, knockoffs. In fact, they're often very much the same thing. They're not expensive. I'm looking at, for instance, the Auratech iStream Bluetooth audio receiver. It's $30. Has a big old headphone jack. That's what you'd plug into your AV receiver, and then it would become a transmitter. You'd have to also add Bluetooth. You're going to almost get two different devices because that would work fine on your smartphone, for instance, or anything that had that could pair with it.
Right.
But what you want is you're going to also want a receiver. And there are a number of these. Rocketfish, for instance, makes makes a Bluetooth music receiver. It's about $50. Both ends should be pretty affordable, under $100 to do both ends. A lot of companies make these. I don't have a particular recommendation for one that's better than another. Maybe somebody in the chat room has some that they recommend. But you're going to want one that plugs into the, I presume, plugs into the, actually, what we'd really love, and I don't know if anybody makes something like this, is one that doesn't plug into the phono jack on your receiver, but plugs into your optical audio out. That would be the best.
That would be,
Because then it'd be all digital. It'd stay digital as it's transmitting to the Bluetooth receiver. And then it'd be, so you would have the least degradation. Let's see. Luddite in our chat room is...
Yamaha...
Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say the Yamaha, it's a Yamaha receiver. Now, they sell a Bluetooth connector for that, but they want like $150.
Yikes!
With a little Bluetooth transceiver.
Yeah, there's a high profit in that.
Yeah.
Because the no-name ones are $20, $30. And I guarantee you all they're doing is slapping a Yamaha sticker on there. So I would just, you know, you can go to Amazon and shop around for Bluetooth transmitters. There's a lot of them on there. Let's see if we can find somebody who's going to give us a recommendation in the chat room or add it to the website at techguylabs.com. If you use one of these, let us know what works. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, what we'd like is a... optical audio Bluetooth transmitter. How to add Bluetooth headphones to your HDTV. Oh, here's an article from How To Geek. Yeah, optical would give you the best audio out. And here's some recommendations. The MPOW StreamBot, $28. Yeah, that's not optical, unfortunately. Bridges your Bluetooth device to your speakers or your Bluetooth speakers to your audio device. Yeah, just have to pick carefully, I guess. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. Jose Modesto, you're next. Hi, Jose. Leo Laporte here.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome.
Thank you. I have a quick question. I have a Windows PC, Windows 10.
Yeah.
My quick question is, what will happen after the one-year free upgrade? Will it stop after that?
No, it's free. Now that you've done it, it's free forever. So, and by the way, I don't think there's going to be a Windows 11. I mean, who knows? Microsoft has said there will not be, that this is the last version of Windows. Once you install it, one of the things you agree to if you take advantage of this free upgrade from Windows 7 or Windows 8.1 is that you will continue to accept updates. You can't refuse updates. That's fine. That's a good thing for security. So they're just going to keep it up to date. In fact, there's going to be a big update. They call it the anniversary update at the end of next month that will bring you up to a lot of new features, a lot of improvements. So it was unclear because Microsoft said free for a year, right, when they released this upgrade. They said, if you're using Windows 7, Windows 8.1, you can upgrade free for a year. And the question a lot of people had, like you, is, well, what happens at the end of that year? Well, they've been very clear. Nothing. It's yours now. If you've been waiting and you want to upgrade to Windows 10 for free, you have 6 more weeks. It ends July 29th. So go out there and do it. In fact, here's a little tip. Even if you don't want Windows 10, but you want to kind of lock in the free Windows 10, do it. Do the upgrade, activate Windows 10, and then go back to whatever version you were using before. Reinstall Windows 7 or 8 and continue to use it. But once you've accepted the offer and activated Windows 10, that computer will always have access to Windows 10 for free. So you're done, Jose. You got it. It's yours. It's activated, right? It says Windows 10 and it says activated.
Not yet. I don't know why, but I've been trying to read. The thing is that hasn't been activated, but that's my question. After July 29th, will be non-responsive or will...
No. I mean, you. Okay, so yeah, I see what you're saying. So now, if you just took a PC with no Windows on it and you install Windows 10, you can use it for 30 days. But after the trial period runs out, it will get less and less effective, and pretty soon it'll stop working. So yeah, you want it, you want now. Are you upgrading from Windows 7 or Windows 8?
Yeah, Windows 7.
Okay, so if you had Windows 7 on your machine, and Microsoft offered the Windows 10 upgrade to you, which it'll do, by the way, in recommended updates for almost everybody. The only reason they wouldn't is if they knew there were hardware incompatibilities that would make Windows 10 not work on your machine. But did you get the offer that said free Windows 10?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And you accepted it? And then
yeah.
Have you downloaded and installed it?
Yep.
And it's still not activated?
Yeah, it has. I'm just waiting, you know, but yeah.
How long ago did you install it?
Let's see, I think at the beginning of this month.
Oh, something's wrong because it should activate almost instantly. Was Windows 7 an activated legit copy?
Yes.
Hmm. So I think it's time for a call to Microsoft to say what's going on, because I took advantage of the free upgrade. If you are upgrading from an activated, legitimate copy of Windows, and you upgrade to Windows 10, it should activate. And my experience is activates almost immediately, like within minutes. And once it's activated, that's it. You won't be, you know, there won't be any timeout. If it's still not activated, no, you're absolutely right. You will time out. It won't be July 29th. It'll time out in about a month, 30 days after you installed it. So I would figure this out. Maybe roll back. You have 30 days to roll back. Roll back to Windows 7. Make sure your Windows 7 is genuine and it's activated. That could be a cause for a problem. But if it's both, your Windows 10 should as well. My only concern was maybe you got a copy of Windows 7 that wasn't. You know, unfortunately, there are guys out there, scammers really, who build you a PC and then use the same copy of Windows 7 over and over and over again. And it's not legit. It's not a real copy. So I would first make sure that you have a legit copy of Windows 7. You should have, you know, a serial number and all of that stuff, and that it's activated before you upgrade to Windows 10. That's the only thing I could think of. But if not, call Microsoft and say, hey, why is this not activating? This should be activating by now. It's, you know, by the way, criticism as we've given Microsoft for kind of tricking people into upgrading to Windows 10, it's a good upgrade. I would say there's no reason not to do it. It's a very good version of Windows. The only reason not to do it is if you have software or hardware you know won't work with Windows 10. You know, there's something about Windows 7 you want to keep, or you're just not comfortable with the new user interface. It's completely your right, in my opinion, not to upgrade, and I think it's slimy of Microsoft to trick people into upgrading. But having said that, Windows 10, I think, is a very good version of Windows. And if you have the opportunity and you have the inclination, take it now. You only have 6 more weeks. You know, somebody's pointing out Jose probably wouldn't have gotten the invitation to upgrade to Windows 10 if his Windows 7 weren't a legit copy. I think that's true. So the fact that he got the invitation means, A, Microsoft says you have a legit copy of Windows 7 or 8, and your hardware is compatible, your software is compatible. So the invitation is Microsoft's way of saying, no, you're good. So it should activate. You do have to go online to do that. Make sure you're online and all that. One more call before we wrap things up, and that's Betty in Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Betty.
Hi. I have a Mac, and I happen to think when I was talking to your gal that answered, she asked me when it started. I cannot get into the Internet. When I try to go onto the Internet, I get that little circle. It's trying to find a plugin. It says there are no plugins. I can use the computer otherwise, but finally I found something that said the browser's not in your preference list. Now I have 3 browsers.
Okay, slow down. Hold on. Okay. So when you look at your menu, so you're using Wi-Fi?
I have a router.
You have a router. When you look at your Wi-Fi menu, you know that's that little Vesuvius, upside down Vesuvius triangle in the menu bar. When you look at that, do you see your router? Is that one of the options given to you?
I don't remember seeing that. I don't know.
So that's the first thing you want to check is in your menu bar on the right there, next to the date and time, there's going to be a little triangle. That's the Wi-Fi access. And you're going to take a look at that. You can also, if it's easier, open the Under the Apple, it says System Preferences. You can open the Network System Preferences and take a look. And make sure, first of all, that you can see your Wi-Fi access point and that you're connected to it. So it's possible you're not connected to it, or it's possible you can't see it.
I think I did that, and I think it said I was connected.
Okay. It will also, in that network box, where you, the network thing that you opened up from the system control panel or preferences, it will also tell you if you have an internet connection. And it will tell you what internet address it gave you. Now, sometimes if the Wi-Fi router isn't working properly, it will see it, it will connect to it, but it won't get on the internet. Okay. And if that's the case, it'll give you an address that's what we call a local address that begins with 168. And that may be the problem. If that's the problem, then your Wi-Fi adapter needs to be reset. You might unplug it and plug it in again, see if that works. Or you may need a new one. If you're online properly, if everything looks normal, then there's something going on with your Mac itself. And that's going to be impossible for me to diagnose. And that's one where you want to get a smart neighbor kid or get a technical guy to take a look at it, because there's something else going on. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on. And on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.